Hey folks, Sam Jones here. You know, historically, I have not generally been one for taking the easy way out. I work hard, and I think putting out a high-quality, compelling product, whether it's a film or a photograph or this podcast, it requires a lot of work, time, and learning. However, back when I first realized I needed to build a website, I didn't even know where to start. Even if I had worked hard, I'm sure it would have turned out looking like crap. And there was no easy solution back then. You had to find some guy who had his own business, and you started drawing things on paper, and you hoped he understood it, and it took months, and you paid a whole bunch of money, and then the back end never worked. That was the beginning of my website experience, at least. And, you know, unfortunately, there was just no easy way to do it. But there is now, and it's called Squarespace. Squarespace provides intuitive, understanding tools for building a professionally designed site, regardless of your skill level, even if that level is zero. Plus, their secure, state-of-the-art technology ensures your site will be secure and stable. That's why it's trusted by millions of people and by many respected brands. The service starts at only $8 a month, and if you sign up for a year, you'll get a free domain. Go to squarespace.com and start your free trial today. There's no credit card required, and when you decide to sign up, make sure to use the offer code OFFCAMERA to get 10% off your first purchase and to support the show. Squarespace. Build it beautiful. Hello and welcome to another edition of Off Camera. I'm your host, Sam Jones, and in this episode, I sit down with model, entrepreneur, and author Cindy Crawford. In these introductions, I usually talk about why I wanted to have a particular guest on the show. But as I'm recording this, I realize for at least half of America, any explanation beyond the words Cindy Crawford is probably completely unnecessary. On the other hand, when you've been the face of so many iconic photos and cultural moments, people can tend to stop at the surface. And while those people could certainly be forgiven for that, they'd be missing some valuable insights behind the images. There are lessons you tend to accumulate when you go from picking corn and cleaning houses for minimum wage to virtually defining the terms supermodel and mega brand with absolutely no precedent or guidebook for the journey. They're also the focus of Cindy's new book, Becoming, a series of photos and essays she's releasing to mark her 50th birthday. Yeah, she's 50. Get over it. In our conversation, Cindy talks about the early family hardships that forged her personality, her uncertainty about dropping out of school to pursue a career that was far from guaranteed, and suddenly being the face of a moment that redefined how the world saw her job and her entire industry. We also get into body image, her potentially career-killing decision to pose for Playboy, and how she developed the confidence to turn her personal brand into a mega brand, and also what she was really thinking about on her very first Vogue cover. As much as there is to envy about Cindy Crawford, after you listen to our show, I think you'll agree there's even more to relate to. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hi, Cindy.
Hi, Sam. How are you?
Good. Thanks for doing this.
Thanks for having me.
I've had a really good week reading your book and rereading it, and it's really amazing because we're about the same age, and reading your book was sort of like hitting all the points over the last 30 years of fashion and art and photography, and sort of also seeing this collection of these photographers that I admired coming up. And the truth is, like, these are the masters of the last half of the 20th century, and you were their muse. And so it's just been amazing. But it's also, you know, I start reading the book and then something will come up in the book and I'll go to YouTube. Like, I watched the George Michael video again.
Yeah.
And I watched the Pepsi commercial. And but it's also sort of depressing, I have to say, because I watched the Pepsi commercial and then I figured out the age of those two boys watching you drink the Pepsi can. They're like 35 now.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. No, it's funny. That is funny. I don't think about things like that. I try not to.
But it made me think, like, okay, you decide to do a book like this, and it's a look back, it's a memoir. And I just wondered what emotions came up in terms of, I don't know if it's accepting the aging process or dealing with it, or if just looking at your life all sort of laid out like that brought up some different thoughts for you than you ever have ever had before.
Well, just that whole process of looking back brought up so many feelings, great memories, things I forgot, or, you know, as you start to, because memory is so subjective and cloudy, you realize how your mind can play tricks on you. But I think the most valuable thing for me of doing the book was realizing, and it kind of all started from, I did Oprah's Masterclass. I don't know if you've ever seen that show, where the whole idea is that everyone's a teacher and everyone's experiences, even though mine are in the world of fashion and yours are through being a photographer and the things that you do, the lessons are universal. The experiences are not.
Right.
So my publicist and a woman that has worked with me for 15 years, they've been bugging me to do a book, but I was like, I don't want to do like a big coffee table book with just great images of me. Like, it's kind of like glory days, like, oh, look what I used to be and not anymore. That didn't seem what I don't know, it just didn't seem like me. And it also didn't, I just don't see my career as a coffee table book. But after doing Masterclass and I was having lunch with my publicist, Annette and Catherine, and we were starting to plan, as we do, like, okay, what's the next 2 years, 5 years going to look like? And knowing that, like, turning 50 was on the horizon, which, you know, is crazy. I can't believe that I'm turning 50. And over that lunch, this kind of idea was, the original idea was, like, 50 iconic images, which right. was not a problem. Like, I knew I could come up with 50 images that I felt like marked my career. But to marry that with kind of 50 lessons that I learned along the way, the journey, why it all matters, you know, because even though it's great having those old pictures, it's kind of like, what does it add up to? It adds up to more than 50 great pictures, I think.
Sure, sure, of course.
It's your life.
Of course.
And the lessons. So when I kind of wrap my head around that, like as an overall concept, that got me excited because it was like, why? I could have been a doctor. I could have been my mom was a, you know, stay-at-home mom for most of her, you know, most of my childhood anyway. I could have done any of those things. I still would have learned lessons. Mine just happened to come, you know, clothed in couture.
Right. Well, that's the sense I get from the book and from knowing you a little bit, is that whatever you were going to do, not only were you going to get lessons out of it, but you were going to approach it with a seriousness and a depth that, I don't know if in the end it really mattered what you chose, you were going to get the full benefit of life out of it. And that's what I got from this book a lot. Mm. But I wanted to go back a little bit. There were some things that I didn't know that were really tough to read. And you know, right at the beginning of the book, you talk about your brother who died, mm-hmm. who I think when you were 10, mm-hmm. right, of leukemia. And you said something so sadly profound in the book. You said that you had two other sisters as well, and he was the youngest, and you said that you had wished it was one of you that had died because it didn't seem fair that your parents lost their only boy, and that you wanted to be like good girls to not cause your parents any more pain. And I just think like that must have ripped your family apart to go through that. And I wonder if that was, you know, because you also say that 3 or 4 years later, that sort of was probably the catalyst that caused your parents to divorce. Mm-hmm. And you said in the book, you say that was the end of my childhood innocence.
Yeah, but in a way, again, it's like in looking back through the lens of time, which is really what this book is about, I can see the gift even in that. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I wouldn't wish losing a child on anybody. And as a mother, I remember as soon as I had my first child, my son Presley, I called my mom and I was like, okay, how did you survive? Like, how do you survive a loss of a child? I don't know. And she said, well, I had three other kids that were like, what's for breakfast, Mom? It's not that we were unaffected by it, but life goes on for the other three kids. And she couldn't just crawl into a ball for a month. You know, she had to go on. And so for me, looking back, like I realized that when you do experience loss like that as a child, you're still a kid, so part of you thinks, well, my brother died, but it could not have been me. Do you know what I mean? Like, because our brains can't really comprehend that at that age. But you also realize that things don't always have the fairy tale ending, or that life is not to be taken for granted.
Well, I wonder if that did set in stone some of your early personality trait, because it's true, you do sort of have to just keep going. And I just wonder if maybe that event helped you mature and grow up, or maybe it made you grow up faster in a way and sort of see the world for what it is, whereas some kids, they get sheltered from that for so long. Do you think that had anything to do with the way you approached your life from that forward?
I think even before he died, even just when he got diagnosed, it's like a total, you know, because when a child gets diagnosed with, you know, a life-threatening illness, it's a family diagnosis, financial burden on the parents. You know, my mom was spending so much time driving him back and forth to the hospital. It was kind of like we were just, you know, staying with my grandmother or staying with cousins, and, you know, just farmed out to whoever would take care of us. And, you know, when he died, it was just, you know, I still remember, like, we were staying the night at my grandmother's that night, and my, because they were going to go to the hospital in the morning. And I remember seeing my mom and my dad in having breakfast, I mean, in the kitchen when I came up for breakfast, and they weren't with my brother. And it was like you didn't even, they didn't need to say anything. It was just like, it hit me like, you know, and then it was just like this sound of everyone starting to cry. I mean, it was like, truly, it's like that, you know, certain moments in your life are just, every sense is crystallized. But that does, you know, it does shape you. And seeing how my mom just dealt with that, I feel like helped me learn to overcome, you know, when I don't, just to go on and to choose happiness.
Well, it sounds like you absorbed that lesson, even though maybe you didn't know you were absorbing it,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So for people who don't know, you grew up in DeKalb, Illinois, which is outside of Chicago, 50 miles?
It's 60 miles straight west, but it's not suburban. It's like a small town, especially then.
It's rural.
Yeah, I mean, there's a town surrounded by cornfields.
Okay.
And it's flat.
And what I didn't know, because you're so modest in all the time I've spoken to you, is that you were class valedictorian.
Yes.
And you got a full ride to Northwestern.
Yes.
To study, and you were going to study chemical engineering, which you started. And, you know, I know you grew up very blue collar, very middle class, and I find that amazing. And I, you know, I hear this story about your brother, and I think, you know, I have a sister who was also valedictorian, and I think she too just wanted to make sure that my parents were happy with her. And I think about you graduating top of your class and going on, and then you end up in modeling.
Yeah.
And I just wonder if, from the beginning, did people underestimate you?
I think I probably underestimated myself. I think that's more, and I talk about it in the book, where the first time I had a student teacher in fourth grade, and she, when she left, gave everyone like a little, you know, paper metal-looking thing, and, you know, with like, I don't know, like best smile or whatever. She kind of found something individual about each kid to recognize. And what she recognized about me was it said future Miss America. Now, I had seen Miss America pageant, never thought about Miss America, and nor was it something I aspired to. But she was dreaming bigger for me than I allowed myself to dream. It's like, it's interesting because you know my husband, you know Randy,
sure.
And it's like he was raised not that much different. I mean, they definitely had more than we did, but I think the way I was raised, it's more that Midwestern Protestant, save for a rainy day, Chicken Little, the sky is falling. And because of what I'd seen play out in my life, my brother dying, my parents getting divorced, like I didn't feel like anything's possible. Like I didn't dream big enough.
I totally get that. I mean, I grew up working at Taco Bell and taking, you know, odd jobs in the neighborhood, yard work. And I you know, I wonder reading about you, and you picked corn and you babysat and you cleaned houses and all for minimum wage. I wondered if when you first got your first few modeling gigs and you saw the checks coming in, did that seem like a lot of money to you? And Like, how was your relationship with money? Like, how hard was it for you to have a mind shift, you know? Or does it still affect
you? It still affects me. But what's really interesting, and you have a sibling, so you know, like, my sisters, and I have an older sister and a younger sister, they did not feel poor growing up, and I did.
Interesting.
So it just goes to show it's all, like, expectations and how we see the world, right? Because they were raised exactly the same as me. I mean, sometimes we didn't have, you know, especially after my parents split up, then you're dividing the money two ways. And I mean, I remember times where we didn't have enough money for my mom to go to the grocery store to get milk. It was like we were out of milk and we had to wait until grocery day, like 2 days later or whatever. And so when I started making money, like my very first paying modeling job was for bras, and you got double time for the minutes that you were on set. It's like, it's not like you got double time for the whole day, but if you were on set for half an hour, that half hour was double. And my rate was $75 an hour. So for that first half hour I was on set, I made $150. So I didn't care that it was plastered all over my high school. I was like, do you know how much money I made doing that? Like standing there in a, and it wasn't like a sexy Victoria's Secret bra. It was like some like granny crush your heart bra. But when it started becoming weird, and it happened quickly, is when I started making a lot more money than my parents, like very quickly.
Well, you were probably still 18.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they could not give me any advice like how to spend it, how to save it. I mean, they had never, all of a sudden I was having problems that were just outside of their area of knowledge. They didn't, like, they didn't know how to invest extra money because they never had extra money. Randy's helped me, and I think I've helped him. Like, we balance each other because Randy's let's spend it. It will make more, you know? And I'm like, but what if, you know? So he's helped me feel more secure, but also to realize that what do you make money for? It's not to just sit there and count it. It's to enjoy it and to share it. And then, but I've helped him, I think, sometimes realize, like, let's really think about, like, is this how we want to, where we want to put our, you know, our resources?
Right, right. Well, I mean, it brings up a larger theme, which I took away from reading about you, which is that there wasn't a blueprint for a lot of things that you did throughout your life. And we have to talk about Victor Skrebnevsky. He was sort of the big Chicago photographer. Your first real professional experience, right?
So Victor Skrebnevsky was like the photographer in Chicago. Like if you weren't working with Victor in Chicago, it was like you were never going to be a top Chicago model. And so I had gotten called in to see him several times, and like the first couple times didn't even get to see him. Like his studio manager kind of was like, okay, thanks, you can leave now, whatever. But I kept chugging along. They kept calling me in, like they'd see something and I'd go in again, and they booked me. And I did learn so much from Victor, but if he hadn't pushed me out the door, I might have just stayed there and probably had a great life. Like,
well, that story's fascinating because you got a job overseas, mm-hmm. right, a big job. And he had you booked for like a half a day, and this was like, what, a 10-day job or something?
Yeah.
Right? And he said, what did he said that if
well,
you take this job?
I don't
job,
think he said directly to me, but it was, so my agency, because we were like, it wasn't even, he would just do this thing where he had permanent first hold on my time.
Right.
Even if he didn't know what the job was, but he thought he might get a job and he would want me because I was like his girl then. And he was holding this half day for something. It wasn't anything like major. And I got an offer, this other editorial trip to Egypt. And it was just like, we just didn't get jobs like that in Chicago.
Right.
So we asked, could he just release that half day so that I could do this other thing? And the message I got back was no. And if you cancel, I will never work with you again. And he...
Which is so controlling, you know, when you think about it, like, because he is the biggest guy in your life right at that point.
But I think he probably felt that he made me and that he was loyal to me in a lot of ways, which he was, and that I should be loyal to him. But it's kind of like creating something and then not letting it... It's like training a singer and not letting them go out and,
right.
and sing.
You also told me, or I read it in the book, that he made a comment to you about you having a hard face to photograph.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and what I took from that reading between the lines was he was kind of saying, oh, you're going to fail in New York because
they won't know how to photograph you. Only I know how to make your face work. And you think about all the things that adults can say to people or professionals can say to people who are starting out that may have been an offhand comment, but it sticks so hard. That happened to me as a photographer young with a certain thing that I thought about it for 10 years, and I'm sure the person who said it forgot about it 10 minutes later.
Right.
But did you sort of carry that around a little bit? Like, did his voice stay in your head a long time after you left Chicago?
It's still in my head, and it's funny. Because my face is very not symmetrical. And sometimes you see it more than others, and depending on lighting or whatever. And it so happens that the way he lights, it was very beautifying for my face. And I learned a lot from him, and I learned how to work with that light. So when he said, yeah, I bet I don't have an easy face to photograph and that no one else was going to be able to make me look good. I don't think it was kind of backhand. It was like him saying, like, you won't make it in New York. So the fact that I went anyway, I guess in retrospect, I can give myself a little...
That's pretty amazing, yeah.
...pat on the back for. But I do, and sometimes I mean, even to your lighting guys today, I'm like, my face isn't that easy to photograph, whatever. And I don't want to jump ahead, but when I learned how to do covers, really, and Richard Avedon really told me, have a thought. And he's like, I don't care what the thought is. Even if it's buy me, I'm $3, you know, the price of Vogue.
Right.
My first thought was, Victor, I'm working with Richard Avedon. You know, it was like that's what was in my eyes.
Well, it's funny. It's exactly the moment that I wanted to pull out of that part of your life was, you know, I photograph a lot of actors, and I can tell when there's not a thought, mm-hmm. or when the thought is, am I looking good?
Am I getting out of here?
Yeah, or whatever it is that's not, you know, taking it one step further. You can see that, and it makes the whole picture kind of have an energy that doesn't feel human. And it's funny how you can pick up, like I can read your book, and I've been doing this for so long, and yet it was so profoundly simple.
Hmm.
And it makes me think, like, God, what an amazing front row seat you had that I would kill for to see all of these different photography masters and the way they worked and the way their methods were different. I guess it just brought up a question for me about, was that around the time when you realized that modeling was a real craft and an art that you could better yourself at, and there was layers to it?
I actually think the first time I really saw it as more than just being pretty and putting on pretty clothes was at Skripnesky Studio when I watched Iman and, like, Diane DeWitt or Joan Severance work. Like, seeing how they, you know, and what I do now, it's like, as a model, when you put on the clothes, it's like I'll say to the stylist or the designer, what is important to you about this outfit? Is it about the waist? Is it about the shoulder pad? Is it about the flow of the fabric? Because it's like, where are you putting your light, right? Like, you might ask a designer, like, if you're shooting a fashion campaign, like, are you trying to show, what's important to you? Because you
exactly.
put the light more on the face or more on the hair or whatever. So I like to understand the clothes. And I saw, especially Iman, like, I just remember watching her, and it was like she made the outfit, like, she elevated the clothing. And that's what a model's job is. So
right.
I didn't have the skills yet, but I saw that it is a skill.
Stay with us, because after the break, Cindy talks about having a front row seat to the working methods of fashion's greatest photographers.
Let's talk about Squarespace. You know, one of the most fun things, I think, about creating anything is when you finally get all your pieces in order and you can start building and playing. And the problem with building a website in the past is that so much of it was about the coding and the architecture, and by the time you got everything working, design was a secondary thought. But with Squarespace, you get to do all the fun stuff right away because they've worked out all the architecture and all the back end. So you just get to play with design and make a beautiful website without any experience whatsoever. I mean, Squarespace has figured out what people want. We want to go to a website, we want it to be beautifully designed, simple to use, and we don't want it to cost an arm and a leg. And with Squarespace, there's no coding, there's no huge back end. It's just a beautifully designed, professional-looking site that you can create for your business, your portfolio, your cat, whatever you want. At $8 a month, you can create a website for your website. Squarespace will handle the state-of-the-art technology needed to power your site and ensure its security and stability. Comforting words, right? Squarespace starts at only $8 a month. You get a free domain if you sign up for a year. So start your free trial site today with no credit card required at squarespace.com. And when you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use the offer code OFFCAMERA. That not only keeps us in business and able to put these podcasts out for free, but it also gets you 10% off your first purchase. So it's a win-win. Squarespace, build it beautiful. You describe how you took a little piece from each photographer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like your description of Irving Penn was that he photographed you like a still life, mm-hmm. which as another photographer, that's sort of, you know, that's not a style I would ever be able to use, but I envy that occasionally because occasionally you do just want to walk in and move someone's elbow like this.
Yeah.
But that's not me and that wouldn't feel right to me. And then you talk about Peter Lindbergh and how he can get a darkness out of somebody or a mm-hmm. more soulful authenticity mm-hmm. And I wonder if watching these different people work and then seeing the results, it's almost like probably seeing a different person, like how a photographer can see you in such a unique way that Peter Lindbergh can make you look a way that Irving Penn can never make you look.
Or Helmet or any of or Herb.
Right.
It is, that's what makes it fun. I mean, but that goes with hair and makeup and styling too.
Sure.
And that's what I try not to micromanage too much. I mean, it's hard. Because kind of once you get famous, then you have like your team, like your people, right? Or people want you to every time. We want Cindy Crawford. We want the hair. We want the boobs. We want like Jessica Rabbit type thing, you know? And that can get boring after a while. But everyone kind of gets stuck in that. And so for me, I mean, yes, you want protection to a certain point that you know, you look good. But you have to be willing to play. And like I love working with young photographers too. Not the ones that are trying so hard. If they're trying too hard to do something new, that's not fun. But if just the way they happen to see me is different and new, that's cool.
Right.
But it's interesting, like we were talking about Irving Penn before and like that Irving would move you. And he didn't, let's say he set you, like,
uh-huh.
or if you said do that, but then maybe like, I'd let you get it, take a few
sure.
frames, but then I might do that, right? Because I might, and you might say, oh, that looks amazing. Or you might say, oh, no, go back. And I'm fine with that. Penn didn't even want you to do that.
Oh,
do you
really?
Know, he didn't really want you to bring. It was like I felt like harnessed because it's like sometimes you have an idea as a model how you can make the picture better.
Right, right. I mean, I think honestly, if you don't allow your subject to take what you've sort of started with and take it somewhere else, you may be missing. Like, I always say the best idea in the room wins. I don't care if it comes from, mm-hmm. you know, the guy who brought the sandwiches. If he
that's
says, oh, hey,
not
why
a big ego, maniac.
That corner. No, but I mean, I think that that's, you know, the film directors that I admire sort of say that too. Like, mm-hmm. it really is, you know, an idea is, ideas are easy. Anyone can throw out 10 ideas. It's the execution of the idea.
Right.
And if you're not using all of the tools, and the biggest one being the person you're photographing, mm-hmm. then sometimes you can miss something. You know?
No, but it must be interesting for you on your side, too, because it's hard for me to be objective about myself.
Sure.
So I think that photographers, especially like more celebrity photographers in portraiture, that's a very, you have to be very patient and let the person, the subject, go through their process, make them feel comfortable.
Yeah.
In a way that, look, a model, we don't get coddled in that way. It's like, you don't like the dress, too bad. That's what we're selling today. Put it on. Like, and I still, even now, I do have the power, let's say, on set to go, I don't really like that. Or they'll say, what do you think of this dress? And I'll be like, well, I wouldn't wear it, but it doesn't matter. Like, I'm a model. I'm not a celebrity doing pictures where the clothes are supposed to reflect me in a certain
right,
way.
Right.
I'm used to putting on, it could be hideously ugly. I could hate it. And my job is to make you think that I think this is like the most beautiful thing. And that is what a good model can do.
So let's talk a little bit about the era when things got crazy. And you were photographed by Peter Lindbergh on the cover of Vogue with the four other women that became like the supermodels, mm-hmm. right? It was Tatiana, Christy Turlington, Naomi Campbell, and Linda Evangelista and yourself. And then those same five girls were cast in a George Michael video, Freedom 90,
yeah.
that became like MTV played it all the time.
Yeah.
And this thing happened again that had never happened before. There wasn't a blueprint for like this powerful group of women that became, you know, because it's interesting. Now you look at the cover of Vogue and it's celebrities, and it has been for a long time. Mm-hmm. But in a way, I think you five ushered in that idea by becoming famous.
Maybe, yeah.
To the point of where if you put an unknown model on, the magazine wouldn't sell because people were so used to seeing these models that they felt like they knew.
You know what you just said that kind of was had a little, why was that different? But you said this group of powerful women. And I think even though there were famous models in the past,
uh-huh.
and even though there was even groups, because you could say Kelly Emberg, Kim Alexis, Carol All, like that was
sure.
a kind of a group. I don't know if the perception was the power glamazon. I think that we were somehow, for whatever reason, because really we were just 25-year-old or 24 or 23, however old we were. Naomi was even younger. Young women like tried, but it was like just the look. It was like those shoulder pads, and it was like we looked powerful. We embodied power in a
way. And the
way
you were photographed too, I think.
Yes, and so I think that really was different. And we looked good photographed together, but we each. You know, and I think we talked about this idea that it was almost like you couldn't have cast us better.
If
someone was, because we look good together.
It's like a band.
But we all had our own part.
Right.
And I think that it just, yeah, I don't, it was like, it was, just, I don't know, who knows, the stars were in alignment. Things just exploded.
Well, I wondered, when that happened, you know, I always got the sense from talking to you that either through your upbringing or just who you were as a person, you weren't as worldly or weren't as much of a party person or didn't crave that life as much. And I wondered your initial expectations, like when that cover came out and when there was a little press, say 6-8 months into that sort of thing, mm-hmm. how you saw those other women and how you felt they saw you.
They definitely had more fun than me. I think also by the time that hit, I was already, you know, famous or whatever. I had done my first Vogue cover in 86 or 87.
Right.
You know, and after that first Vogue cover, like I just, you know, like 1 month you'd go to the newsstand, I would be on four covers or, you know, every cover on the newsstand.
So that one cover led to an explosion of covers.
The Vogue, American Vogue.
Right.
So the Peter Lindbergh cover with the group of us was defining in that just he was asked to photograph the face to represent the 90s for British Vogue cover. Liz Tobera said, like, I want you to choose any model you want who you think represents the woman of the 90s. And Peter said, can't do it with just one face. I want to do it with these five women. Like, I feel like they all represent a different face of the 90s. And then George Michael wanted that exact group of women for his video. So we did the video. And then that was when MTV was still, like, everyone watched it, and they still played music all the time. And that video just exploded. It was great. David Fincher directed it.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just, it was great. And then we did the Versace show with that music playing all together, you know, walking down the runway. And to me, that was like, what is this? That's, even though I'd been famous and I was with an act, you know, or I don't think we were married yet, but, you know, had been dating a famous actor. And I had, but that moment, it was like, you felt it. It was like, and even people in the audience, like, wrote about, like, that there was just like, what is this? What is this supermodel phenomena? Like, it was like the first time it was like bringing fashion and culture and music and everything together to, in that one moment.
Yeah.
And then it, I guess the way the world saw us changed a little bit. And then in terms of like my relationship with the other women, and we were together a lot at shows, and then sometimes you, like Christy and I would go on a trip, or, you know, Naomi and I would be booked together.
Right.
And you know, some I'm closer to than others, but for the most part, everyone got along.
Did you look out for each other? And like, because I imagine it's all happening to you all at once, and there's not a lot of other people on the earth that you can call and relate what is happening to you.
I don't remember having any of those kind of conversations, but it'd be fun to go out together because it was like, you know, all three of us would go out dance, or, you know, like if three of you showed up at like Nell's or something and dancing. And
it would just explode the place.
It was like,
right?
What is, you know what I mean? It was just crazy. And because it was mostly around shows, that's when everyone would be in the same city at the same time. Like,
right.
You'd all be in New York for New York Fashion Week, or you'd all be in Paris for Paris Fashion Week. I think that the rest of the time, I was off doing my Revlon. Christy was doing Calvin Klein. Linda was doing, you know, whatever she was doing. And we didn't see each other that much.
Right.
But, you know, we were friendly, of course, and we end up at the same parties and whatever. Mm-hmm. I think the way they saw me was, yeah, I was like the serious one in the bunch. And even I know you work with U2, and even like Bono, that like U2 was around, and Bono's like, yeah, you were the, like, you were always like, you would leave early, and like, I just wasn't a partier. And probably a bit of me would have wanted to party a little bit. I mean, whatever you mean by that, but I just felt like, I just never wanted to be in a situation where I didn't feel like I could in control or take care of myself or whatever. So it was just easier at a certain point in the evening to
right.
You know, go back to my hotel room and read my book.
Did you ever step back from the industry a little bit and look at it and say, okay, I'm this woman who I could have done anything. I fell into modeling. But in high school, I was wearing ERA buttons. Mm-hmm. Like, did you ever look at your industry with a critical eye then, or was it just too, was it too much of the time?
I think it was just too in it. You know, it was,
right.
It's hard to, and that's what's been fun about doing the book is that you, because so much of life, we're just moving forward and doing and doing and doing, but then when you do a project like a book, you take the time to look back, and that's what was great. So in the moment, no, I mean, I certainly understood, like, okay, here I am, a woman that, you know, I always say that I didn't grow up feeling like that I had to prove that I was equal to boys because of all the feminist movement that happened before me. I just grew up thinking I was equal to boys. It was like, I don't have to prove that I'm equal to boys. But definitely worked hard at school and, you know, kind of when I went to college and I was like the only girl in my chemistry class, you know, at Northwestern the first day, you know, kind of feeling like, wait, like, and the teacher said something like, I think you're in the wrong class, honey.
Really?
Yeah. But, so, I mean, I kind of, look, there were moments, like little touches where you kind of, wait a minute, like I could have been in chemical engineering or I became a model. But then I think that there were times where the way that people treated me, just because of the way I looked, was, you know, you're kind of like, hey, I could have done this, or I went to Northwestern, blah, blah, blah. My kids tease me. They're like, yeah, you get that in whenever you can, don't you, Mom? But not too far. I would say probably the time I was 25, I realized that that was saying a lot more about the person than it was about me. Like, if someone treated me like I was dumb just because I was a model, I guess in my own mind, I was just like, well, they're a dumb man. Because they're not getting to know me to see if I'm really that or I'm not that. Later, you know, as I did Playboy and some of these things that were maybe not what the feminists fought for, but my understanding of feminism is being able to make your own choices.
Sure.
And so I never really felt coerced into doing any of those things. I always voted myself in. So I don't know how I kind of got through that, like not feeling victimized, you know. And it's funny, I think Isaac Mizrahi or someone, or maybe Michael Kors, talked about how so many women that are considered beautiful, in a way it's like a curse and a blessing. Like they get, they're not like a, they become like a victim of their own beauty in some ways. And I guess I just, look, I saw it not, it was like a thing that I got to use for a while. Like, it wasn't me. Do you know what I mean?
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you, because at a certain point, I'm sure you looked at Cindy Crawford as this thing
yeah.
that got hair and made up and photographed and trotted out at Runway, but it wasn't you at all, right?
I mean, well, it's rooted in me, or it's an aspect of me, but it's a thing.
You could remove yourself from it and say, there's the public perception, and then there's who I know I am.
Yes, but fortunately, because I'm not a good actress, it's not like Cindy Crawford persona was one thing, like professional and not party girl, and then like the real me was like, crazy.
Right.
Cindy Crawford is me, but it's like a polished, you know, version of me. It's a certain aspect of me, but certainly I have a lot of, you know, I'm a mother, I'm a wife, I'm a cranky mood day, I'm, you know, rolling up this, you know, my sleeves and scrubbing floor. You know, there's many different Cindy's. And Cindy Crawford the model is like one part of that. But it's like a thing. It's a brand. Even when I interview people like to work in my office, I'm always like, look, we all work for Cindy Crawford, even me. Like, I work for that. That's the thing. That's what pays the bills.
That is so interesting. But I think, you know, being inside it, I'm sure it was just a day-by-day transition. But if you step back and look at it from the outside, you go, okay, at one point you had to have develop the self-confidence to kind of pull that off, to where when you probably weren't feeling that way, you still had to be that.
Yeah, it gets harder. I always say it's like, it's almost, I don't know if this is appropriate, but I always say like I need like Viagra for modeling sometimes these days, because it's just harder to get it up.
Right.
You know, it's especially because most of the times it's not
new. I'm sensing a new sponsor for Off Camera, by the way.
Modeling Viagra, perfect. So that's not true when the magic is happening at all. It's like I still get to be around creative people or whatever. But there's, you know, there's still jobs that I do that are, you know, they're not as fun. And it's harder to bring it for that because I've just done it a lot. Which is actually good because it helps me move on to – it helps you make the transition into whatever that next phase is going to be. Because it's like it's easier to move away from something if you don't – want it as much anymore.
You don't need it as much.
Yeah.
Right. But, you know, what I guess I was getting at more was that sort of how no one knows what it's like to lose their privacy until it happens to them. And I remember we met you guys for dinner a while ago, and we were on time, which I know you like when people are on time. We are the same way exactly, my wife and I. But I guess Jen walked up to you first, my wife, and said, and you said, oh, I'm so glad you guys are here. I didn't want to sit at the bar by myself because I think Randy was coming in a different car.
And he, unfortunately, is not of the same ilk as us about time.
And you know, it made me think, yeah, that must be a lot harder. Like, that fishbowl feeling has to hit you sometimes.
Yeah.
And that must be really difficult. And I'm sure at the height of that supermodel craziness, it's easy to say, okay, their lives were great and amazing and you can't complain about anything. But it made me wonder, like, what was the hardest thing about that time, about the uber famous time in your life?
The hardest is when you're famous. It's easy to be famous when everything's going great in your life. You know what I mean? I mean, sometimes it's annoying at the grocery store or whatever, but it's not that hard. I mean, it's hard when maybe things aren't going great in your personal life and those are plastered all over. And so, like, for instance, when I divorced my first husband, or when we got divorced, because it's not for the reason that people would think. It's not like that you're embarrassed or whatever. It's just that you're still processing. You're still trying to figure out your feelings, and then you're having all this other input. It's like hard enough to separate from someone, just the two of you. But then when you add in everybody else's projection, but I mean, that was even before Twitter and Instagram. I mean, now I in some ways it's so much harder, but in some ways there's so much noise, it doesn't even matter.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. You know, I never thought of it that way, but it sounds like you're saying that you don't get to have a private moment when you really need one.
Right.
Like, you don't really need one when you're going to the grocery store and everything's fine. You have to maybe say hi to somebody. I get that. That's the price of fame.
But now everyone has a camera, and so you're like, I better put the sunglasses on, or I better cover up that zit or whatever, because you're going to be on someone's Instagram, and they're either going to say you look great, or you look like crap. And you're like, I'd rather be the one. So at the grocery store, I'll be like, can we just face the front of the store because the lighting's better, you know?
You're turning someone around.
Yeah. But it's, you know, now being famous, because there's just cameras every, you're to think that you are not being documented every moment that you're outside of your house, you're kidding yourself.
And you think about it in terms of what you've done with yourself as a brand. I think about, there was no such thing as someone taking their lifestyle and personality mm-hmm. and turning it into sort of a global company before you did it in a lot of ways. And I remember that article that came out in Vanity Fair, I think in 93 or 94, mm-hmm. that was Cindy Inc.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And it was sort of the first time probably someone had said someone's name and put ink mm-hmm. after it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting. You never called yourself, you always said, I wasn't the cool girl.
Mm-hmm.
But in a way, I think there was such a huge advantage to not being the cool girl in that you had this public acceptance or this relatability to people. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you looking back now and going through the book, if you can sort of see the seeds and when they were sown of you making that transition, because you have this amazing business acumen and mm-hmm. you've created this thing that didn't really, like now, of course, if a model's coming up, I'm sure it's just standard practice to go, okay, what brands am I going to align myself with mm-hmm. and how am I going to turn my lifestyle into, you know what I mean?
Well, I think that, you know, look, as a model, when you're first, you're just like, who wants to hire me? And I can say yes or no, but normally you say yes in the beginning to everything,
sure.
unless it's something like, you know, that you really, like a cigarette thing maybe or something that you go, that's not me. But then slowly you kind of start developing an on-camera or in front of the camera personality or, mm-hmm. or like image, how people see you, right? And then you unconsciously probably make decisions that feed that. And some people don't, and maybe that's like why, like, Linda was the chameleon. Like, you couldn't really put your finger on on Linda. Whereas me, it was like Revlon, Pepsi. It was like American. It was accessible. It wasn't Hermes and like super exclusive. And then so the more like those companies come to you, then the more choices that you make that you go, does this fit with my other brand alignments? Like you, it's kind of, it happens from both ways. It's how it's what the world kind of puts on you. And then you kind of hopefully understand how people see you or want to see you or where they believe you or where they can trust you and where your integrity can come through. And then you make choices to reinforce that back.
Right.
And so I always make this decision, like, would my sisters like this? Like, uh-huh. would they understand this? Could they afford this? It might be slightly aspirational for them, but it's not like, you know, doing a Bugatti car ad where it's like, you know, that's like 10 people in the world can afford that or whatever. You
sure.
know what I mean? It's like Revlon.
Sure.
It was aspirational. It's color. But, you know, a lipstick is affordable. And it's like a fashion statement in a tube. You know, it's like that one little thing that even more than like designer clothes, a lot of people can't afford. They can aspire to, but they try to find like this look for less. And I, in some ways, I made the choice of the Revlons of Pepsi, the this look for less, which was a choice. And I think there were times where I sort of regretted it because, you know, there's some amazing campaigns that are super high fashion that look, we all have envy, right?
And that's the trade-off, right?
Yeah.
Like you made a decision to connect with a larger group of people that was more in line with the way you grew up.
And partly because that was the path of least resistance, and I don't have a high fashion body, and it's just like that's who wanted me, and then that's who made sense, and then that's who I wanted. Do you know what it became like a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Was there a moment where it dawned on you, oh, this is really exciting, I can do so much more with this, and I, like, almost an entrepreneurial sort of sense that overtook you where you, do you know what I mean? Or did it sort of happen organically, step by step?
I think it happened a little organically and sometimes with me dragging my heels because
oh, really?
it's scary to get into new things. And also I think in the same way that maybe I didn't dream big enough for myself when I was a kid, I didn't trust my own instincts sometime enough. Or And like, so you'll go and you'll sit in a business meeting. Like, I have to go to board meetings now. And, you know, like, the first 20 minutes is always the P&Ls. And even though I was great at calculus, I was a straight A student, literally, like, that is just Greek to me now. I can't even, I just kind of, like, doodle or something while they're doing P&Ls. I mean, I get the top line, but I can't, like, look at that. But what I did realize where I have real value is, like, marketing. I have so much, I mean, I've worked with so many different marketing companies and advertising agencies and PR companies. That's like, I have a lot to contribute, but you kind of slowly, like at first you sit in the board meetings and you don't say anything. And then maybe one time you'll be like, well, one time I was on a job and we did it like this and it worked really good. And they're like, that's a great idea. So then the next time you have something to offer, you're like, you know, one time I was at a shoot and we did it like this. And then the next time people go, do you have any thoughts? Do you know? But you kind of built toward that. I didn't walk in trying to rule the boardroom.
Right.
I walked in knowing what I know. And what I also learned is no one knows my brand better than me. And we all really, like, we're all our own brand.
Sure.
I mean, mine's played out on a bigger stage, but in a way, like, how our brand is how we present ourselves to the world. Like, the second you walk out your door, it's like, how do I want the world to see me? What do I, you know, what kind of attributes do I want associated with me? So it's, I mean, I call it brand just because I come from the world of marketing and branding and advertising.
Maybe it's the identifying.
Your identity.
Right.
The way the world sees you.
Well, it's surprising to say that you had a hard time believing it at first or that you were dragging your feet a little bit because you are so good at it. And you know, I just wonder if you had... did you have a mentor or any kind of business sort of person in your life that helped you through that? Or did you have to sort of just make it up?
Agents are agents. They're good at getting the deal and closing the deal. But it's like the work, a lot of the things I do now, they're businesses. You know, I've been in the skincare business now for over 10 years. I've been in the furniture business now for 10 years. And I'm like, I was trying to manifest. I want a business daddy. And I tried, like, I switched agents for a minute, and I tried all these different things, and then I had this realization that I have to be my own business daddy.
It's funny, I spoke to my wife and my sister and a few other people before doing this, just mm-hmm. wanted to get their take on you. And one of the things everyone says is that they identified with you more because you weren't the heroin chic, mm-hmm. you know, super skinny. But... you also talk in the book about how you had to make a lifestyle change and there's a lot of anxiety and expectation that goes along with your body being the entire, you know, your entire industry, mm-hmm. right? And I wondered at what point in your career you sort of had to look at that on the bigger stage and go, what am I projecting and what is the rest of the industry projecting and how does that work on, I mean, you have a daughter now who's right at that age buying those magazines and, you know, is there a thought of, is what we're presenting as the aspirational way to look and live, is that attainable for a normal girl?
You know, look, all of it, and this is what, you know, what I've come to really realize lately, because there was like, is it retouched or whatever, a picture? No picture is real. Even an unretouched picture is not real.
That's right.
There is no such thing as a real picture. I mean, it just doesn't exist.
Right. Cartier-Bresson said, all pictures are accurate and none tell the truth.
Yeah.
And I love that quote because it is. It's an image. First off, it's two-dimensional, so it's not real right there.
Yeah. And it's editing. I mean, you know, like who, you know... And this is the thing, the danger now that I think with digital photography that I didn't actually even get into my book, but when, you know, as a photographer, you take 200 pictures for that one magical moment. So much of art is editing.
I guess it's hard. I'm on both sides of it because on one hand, I feel like parenting is 90% of it. You give an example of how to live and that's how your kids will live. But I think it came up for a while as, what are we saying? As, you know what I mean?
I think especially kind of the heroin chic look because it was, but again, fashion is a pendulum, right?
That's
and
right.
And so it was powerful, uber glamazon. So where do you go?
you know, wafy.
Wafy, deer in the headlights. I don't even know where I am or what shoot I'm on or whatever. It was completely different body language for a model.
Like, it was not strong and powerful.
No.
But it was submissive.
Yeah, and it was like introspective and not like, hey, I'm here, I've arrived, you know.
Right.
But that's fashion.
That's right. That's right. But, you know, it kind of dovetailed with a lot of media focus also on anorexia and bulimia. Mm-hmm. And those diseases kind of had their moment out in the media where they became popular. And I just remember that time as being like, oh, who are we, you know, is it the media's responsibility? Which, of course, it's not. But it seemed like a moment. You know what I mean?
Because look, we're not going to stop it. It's even worse now because even kids on their Instagram are doing their own photoshopping, right? Like making their waist smaller,
right.
Lifting things up. So, but in some ways that's good because they realize how manipulated photographs
can be. Yeah, maybe it's great because every girl looks at it and goes, well, that's not real.
I think the responsibility and hopefully, you know, and not everyone unfortunately has the correct situation. I mean, like a supportive situation, but it's like, that's your responsibility as a parent.
Well, you make a good point. It's almost like by full transparency of everyone having access to filters and everyone understanding Photoshop to the point where, you know, maybe everyone knowing nothing is real is better than people believing something
yes.
is real that isn't.
I do think that is probably true because I think that, you know, if you see, especially, you know, like I'm 49 years old right now. And you might see an image of me that's been slightly retouched. She doesn't have one wrinkle. She's like, how does she do that? Well, I do, you know. But in a picture, it's probably, you know, they just clean
sure.
it up a little bit. Do I think sometimes people abuse retouching? Yes. But in life, people abuse retouching.
Sure.
And I think my responsibility to my children is just explaining and to that to them, like, it's... You know, it's the perfect light. It's not real.
Right. I know you personally, you know, you have strong beliefs about certain things and whether it's environmental issues mm-hmm. or whether it's, you know, anything having to do with women. Reading your book, one of the things that I took away from it was that you managed to take this thing that you thought would only last for a little bit, and every time it lasted further, you managed to go with it or even lead it. Like even your decision to do Playboy,
mm-hmm.
I think that was a really bold decision at a time when that's not where your industry went, and
no.
people in your industry would say you'll kill your career,
mm-hmm.
and you were ahead of that, and you know it's funny, some of the photographers I like the most, they're less about fashion than they are. I mean, they're portrait artists more than they are fashion photographers. They
right.
just happen to do both very well. But I think the decisions you made have kept you sort of, you know, leading the curve, not only sort of finding your own path, but also sort of trailblazing it for other people.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And it's amazing.
It's nice. I mean, sometimes I get
to look at your career.
Younger models or some people, like young actresses or whatever, and they'll say, like, you know, that's why I did this, or, you know, that's why I started my own line of this. And
sure.
It is. It's satisfying because I'm sure there were a few other people doing it, but there wasn't, like, that one person that I could say, I want that career.
Right.
I didn't even, again, didn't dream big enough, didn't dream far enough, because I did. I thought I was like 25, pre-retire, and then at 25, I was like, yeah, I could probably eke out a few more years. Like 30.
At 25, you're like, I can eke.
Yeah, and then at 30, and at 35, my Revlon contract expired, and in the renegotiations, it just wasn't, I don't know, it just felt like the right time to step away. But here I was 35, and I was like, I'd been with Revlon for almost 20 years. I'm like, what am I going to do? But that is what enabled me to do my own skincare line and, like, really create my own thing and not be a for-hire girl always.
Right, right. That's probably the reason that you are who you are, is that people can relate to you, but they can also go, oh, my gosh, this is a life that, you know, is beyond compare in terms of experience.
Well, and I think, you know, that's, for me, why this book now was that, yes, like, the pictures, like you said, it's like walking down you know, memory lane or just cultural moments, right? Like the Pepsi and the George Michael video and the supermodel, you know, the naked supermodel picture. And so those, you know, to celebrate that career. But the part that I am more interested really are the stories, and hopefully the people will read the stories because they're interesting. You know, you might get a movie star mention or, you know, or a famous photographer, or, you know, whatever. There's like enough to keep it interesting. But really my lessons that I learned are universal. They're not just for someone in the fashion industry. They're for my kids. They're for anybody, you know, learning how to set boundaries or say no or take chances or being willing to like evolve your career. All those things are those apply to anybody. So that's what I'm kind of most excited about, is that the lessons are universal, even though the way that I've learned those lessons has been in an exciting world. But the part of my life that I most connect to and I'm most proud of is my real life, you know, which is at home with the kids, with Randy, with just doing, you know, going on a bike ride and cooking dinner and all piling in our bed together, you know, whatever that real life is. In some ways, it's not even close. It far outweighs all of the other stuff.
Well, Guy, it's interesting to talk to someone this in detail on the other side of the camera too, because it's true, you've had a front row seat to, you know, working with these great masters, and you know, it's a treat for me to be able to read it and sort of, you know, live that period where I was learning how to be a photographer through your eyes. It's a real insight that, I mean, there's not a book quite like it that's out there, so I really enjoyed it.
Well, thank you. Yeah. Thank you so much.
And thanks for coming and doing this.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Hey, folks, you've reached the end of another episode of Off Camera. I hope you're liking the show. And remember, if you want to get the full off-camera experience, go to offcamera.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at @offcameraShow or me at @SamJones. And if you want to get really personal, send me an email, sam@offcamera.com. And if you're not already subscribed to this podcast, go to iTunes and subscribe. And while you're there, take a minute on iTunes and give us a rating. Anything above 4 stars is acceptable. Make sure to tune in next time when I sit down with actress Ellen Page.
For me personally, this isn't, you know, not necessarily for anyone else, but for me personally, it felt like a moral imperative to say, yes, I'm gay, people are gay, they are gay people, always have been, always continue to be, let's try and move this along.
You won't want to miss this fascinating and enlightening conversation. See you next time, off camera.